So you go down this cliff, go left down the cliff, yeah. Left, and then just tumble for a while, and then you should be there.
It's society. They work for each other, they pay each other, they buy houses, they get married, make children.
That just sounds like slavery with extra steps.
I don't know if you've noticed, but our two-party system is abolished looking in the mirror at itself.
I can't wait for the episode of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire where all the contestants team up and they overpower the host and they share the money.
The message of Occupy Wall Street is I would prefer not to play the existing game.
We are a socialist party and there are social solutions to the problems.
Communal lifestyles, I don't know about that.
No one can tell me what to do.
Wow, you're a real anarchist.
And now we had a king. I thought we were an autonomous collective.
No words for you puppets of the West. Communism forever.
God, those communists are amazing.
Welcome to the Three Left Show, which with your host, me, Dan Platt, at 8 p.m. for inaugural Thursday night, late night, later night show. A show that's here to prepare you for a post-capitalist future, best we can. So I'm going to start this show a little light. My Facebook feed, more or less, it's been a buzz. Hot. Roseanne's hot right now. Her new show has just premiered. And her politics are... So a lot of people were prepared to hate it because she declared herself to be a Trump voter. And this doesn't surprise me because I know where she comes from politically. So I didn't really think too much of it. But for those that probably didn't know where she came, you know, she was coming from. So just to speak on it from my point. Yeah.
So Roseanne is back.
She's back on TV.
She's back on TV.
Thanks to Netflix with her show.
Gotta love Netflix.
And
I didn't think
it's truly anything is possible.
Yeah.
And so she was getting a lot of hate from liberals, from the libs, because she was a Trump voter. Because she's so with me in the studio is Jeremy Brock and
Eric Green.
Speak right into the mic.
Oh, Eric Green.
There we go. Shift the mic towards you so that you don't have to lean over. There you go.
We often make jokes that you have to, yes.
Eat the mic.
Eat the mic.
You really need to be like an inch away. It is moving.
Yeah, you don't there have to go. Lick it necessarily, yeah. But definitely.
We're working through it. Oh, great.
Yes.
Sorry, I'm getting hand signals from DJ Nasty, and I can't read lips. So I'm a Green Party member, and I knew from, and I wasn't yet a Green Party member in 2012, but she was one of the, she was running to be a nominee for Green Party presidential candidate. And she disqualified herself, more or less, politically speaking, by being politically incorrect, as it were, by being pro-Israel and bad-mouthing Palestinians. And so she was a populist, left-leaning, environmentalist, owns an almond farm, I believe. And so she kind of saw, I mean, and with the Democratic Party as it is, being elitist, basically funded and catering to Tech Valley and upper-middle-class, professional-class, if you're a populist first for working people, you wouldn't consider the two parties to be your home. So she went green, but then found that Greens weren't very hospitable to her politics because of her imperialist stances or what have you, or just being a homophobe or such at the time. Maybe she's grown on that. But she was kind of, she left the party, and thus being a populist with no other home, then it made sense that, oh, okay, she's a Trump voter. Trump is basically the populist who goes beyond. I mean, it's still, you know, part of the neoliberal system, but being a billionaire, of course, but isn't categorized within the usual left-right liberal conservative dynamic, which is interesting. I have a new neighbor who, after talking with him, you know, he's took in a rescue animal, interested in farmers markets, a rural guy, lots of admirable qualities. And it didn't ruin my perception of him when, you know, I asked him, like, maybe check out the show. And he asked, what was the show about? And I said, oh, it's radical politics. And to a lot of people, politics just means electoral politics or elections. So he instantly just retorted, blurted out, "Oh, I'm a Trump man," and then followed up with, "Now you're going to judge me harshly. Now you're going to prejudge me," or whatever. And I'm like, no, you saying that you're going, you know, that I'm prejudging you is prejudging me. But anyway, where am I going with this? That if you're a Trump voter, there's different reasons. And if you are want outsider politics, if you're anti-establishment, if you want something new and different, if unless you're plugged into radical thinking or other, let's say, left-wing left-wing populism, which maybe you have no access to, you know, nobody in your own life who is like that, then gravitating towards Trump doesn't surprise me. And I guess Roseanne Barr might fit into that, considering she was ostracized by, you know, the left of the left, by various bigoted and otherwise bad, you know, morally uncharacteristical stances that she took. Any thoughts? Yeah. So, never mind. So I just wanted to start with that because that was literally just what I was kind of going on about. So this first hour is definitely going to be geared towards talking about gun control and various stances to it. So, so beware for that. To be clear, my personal stance, representing Three Lefts, is that gun control, I'm okay with it, but since that's disarmament, I would prefer the state disarmed too. So the police, pare down the military to defensive capabilities only, that kind of stuff. Meaning because, well, when we talk about why do we need to be armed, usually because other people are armed. So if we're going to have mutual disarmament, or rather any kind of disarmament, which I'm totally for, a peaceful world, a nonviolent world, it needs to be mutual. Because police are shooting more people than teenagers in schools. And more soldiers are shooting themselves as a form of suicide, and many others. Most gun deaths are suicides. That's caused by underlying anxieties and insecurities and the disease of our economy and all that.
I would say, I mean, we've been living the speak softly and carry a big stick mentality for a long time, ever since, I think it was Theodore Roosevelt used to say that.
That was, yeah, he was attributed to that, yeah.
But I mean, words are a lot more powerful than weapons, I think.
Have we speak softly? I mean, I'm pretty sure that throughout the 20th century, it was always, like, there was always a lot of bluster of, like, if you are threatening America, we will nuke you.
We will, yeah.
And we're developing these weapons. I mean, we always say it's for defense, but, of course, so is everybody. Until they're actually used, and they're used.
Well, how
out of
defensive
fear.
Are nuclear weapons? I don't. Sounds like an oxymoron, like jumbo shrimp or.
Like most, or, I mean, that's the case with most weapons. When yeah. we talk about, oh, I want my weapon for self defense, but I'm going to start with. So okay, what I'm going to do this format for the next hour is I'm going to share a bunch of Facebook posts of varying levels of accommodate, like sympathy for the March for Our Lives. Some of it's really harsh and critical. Some of it is in solidarity, but also, you know, varying forms of critical analysis from the far left. Because the March for Our Lives, as the media, the corporate media has held it up, is that it's nonpartisan, which is, you know, what? And that this goes beyond partisan politics. This is about our lives. Our lives matter. And which, you know, there's this all lives matter kind of feel to it. Even though there were many speakers at several, many of those rallies where people of color would speak and so on. But, you know, there are examples where a person of color wanted to call out police violence and their mic would be cut. And here in Albany, you know, it's a role of democratic politicians, our congressmen, our legislators, and it's basically a line of lectures some of which are very emotional and got a lot of people teary-eyed, and I can understand that. But I wouldn't participate because I've done that before. The whole getting emotional, voting for Dems, which was kind of like, you know, the call of voting out the people who aren't for gun control and won't pass it. Because the clip in the beginning where it was Zizek going, the message of Occupy was, I'd rather not to. I'm from the Occupy movement, and I joined it because I voted in 08. I voted in not so much 06, I wasn't of age at the time. But as soon as I could vote, 08, I voted for Democrats, and it didn't make a goddamn difference in my life. I've certainly, there were probably things to point to, oh, this improved my life. But then they were also doing 100 things that hurt me and hurt people I cared about, communities I was watching that I have empathetic towards. And so Occupy was about, we prefer not to vote. We prefer not to demand things of legislators who don't represent us in the first place. We're about forming our own righteous community for change, because we're going to be the ones to do it. And we're just doing it as a rallying cry, using these political, the language of the 99% and all the stuff that's now practically taken for granted, to say we want something different, something that is not representative government, something that isn't asking for more regulations, because we are skeptical of state power. Because if it's as far as we're not going to appeal to the state to protect us. So just chime in.
Well, I like your,
I want to keep an eye on the time.
I like your perspective on.
So, by the way, I introduced Eric, or Eric introduced himself, but actually, I've just met you, by the way. So I have no idea where you are at. You're a friend of Jeremy's. So I'm really curious.
Well, I guess I like your perspective on gun control being one of mutual disarmament between the state and the citizenry. I think that's something that it's arguing from a place that's much more appealing to the sensibilities of conservatives, because they're thinking in terms of being armed so as to defend themselves against tyranny. Usually that's the talking point, more so than defending against burglars.
I find it amazingly interesting that scattered among some of my Facebook feed on the March for All Lives Matter and the reactions, that the NRA has been propagating left-wing arguments against gun control now. Almost that they've realized that all of their conservative and right-wing arguments are absolutely kind of haven't done the job, or to appeal to under 35s who aren't just about harm reduction anymore, because the ideology of harm reduction isn't enough. We want to eliminate harm. And so to apply that to the economy, for example, I don't want to reduce the harms of the bus. You know, we should have an economy that doesn't have bus and recessions, that makes us all, you know, precarious and desperate workers. So to crystallize one of the points I was making, a quote from a post, a post from Fully Automated Luxury Gay Space Communism. It's a joke name. But it's, there are two reasons the Parkland kids are receiving more positive regard than Black Lives Matter. The first and most prominent, and this is in regard to corporate media, and meaning liberal media, neoliberal media, if some prefer. The first and most prominent example, the first and most prominent is simple racism. The second is that Black Lives Matter offers a direct critique of state monopoly on violence, while Parkland appeals to the state to help stop private violence. And as someone with a revolutionary point of view, I don't see a difference between private and public violence. Violence is violence. If we want less of it in the world, we need to look at both kind of sides or see them as not separate. Just as like to kind of what you bring up, something I've noticed about the kind of arguments me and other far leftists, you know, anarchists or socialists make, is that we don't, in our language, we do not see the government and people as separate, separate entities. That there's the government over here, and we're over here, and we're different. And because, like, if it is representative government, then the government is us, right? Kind of like those little quips about, like, the government's only as good as what we deserve.
It certainly should be represented by us, but is it?
But then it becomes like the revolutionary point of view is then when it really is as bad as it is, then we just need to get rid of it. Like, we need a new form of governance, which is one of the things I push for, which is more direct democracy, more decentralized government, because politics is not just a one-dimensional line of left and right, which is usually defined, which is a 200-year-old point of view where the right would be the state is for protecting property rights and then or protecting the good of property owners, which would be the aristocracy at the time. And then the left is using the state for the common good or the good of commoners. And that's kind of in the minds of, like, using left and right as the binary, it's still the same thing. Like, but now it's like the number of property owners are, you know, is much more, like, especially part of the American system is to make as many people property owners as possible. But there's only so much the market can actually take before it collapses. Well, there has to be tenants, you know, doesn't work otherwise. So let's see, let's go into, I'll go to the harshest one last. So the next one is from the Socialist Rifle Association. Now, if it's hard to believe, there actually are left-wing pro-gun groups, or at least anti-gun control groups. And they come from probably a place that many moderates would find very scary. You know, revolutionaries, we do want to, like, maybe there's some overthrow of government rhetoric like I just kind of used myself. But I'm not a gun owner. But there are also some organizations working to train left-leaning people in gun use. Some are Bernie Sanders people, simply, or others are just really scared of the alt-right and see the guns they tote around. So the Socialist Rifle Association is kind of a... Maybe they're the biggest. I don't know what their membership is. I could look it up. From a comrade. So this is their statement on the March for All Lives. Okay. As I was before the break, I was going to start reading the statement from the Socialist Rifle Association. If you can believe such a thing exists, it does. And there are also other gun clubs that are leftist, like the John Brown Glug Club and the Willie Horton, after another militant leftist.
Is that a diner?
Oh, yeah. Maybe it is, but I know there's Huey Newton. From a comrade, the March for Our Lives is clearly being driven by a very authentic pain and initiative by millions of youth impacted by our country's gross, mind-numbing gun violence. It's just as clear to see that capitalizing on these youth's need to pass legislation to reach their goals, the Democratic Party and its cloud of political organizations is working hard to absorb and direct the movement. This will act as a filter for what narratives about gun violence are highlighted and what demands are elevated. If we're going to talk about mass shootings, let's talk about how many of these shootings are being carried out by people with explicit ties to white supremacist and anti-feminist hate movements. If we're going to talk about gang violence, let's talk about defunding of schools, entrenched generational poverty, racial discrimination, and the failed drug war. If we're going to talk about the police failing to stop criminal gun violence, let's also talk about the gun violence carried out by the police. If we're going to talk about mental health, let's talk about how the number one cause of gun deaths in America is suicide. Gun violence is a steady, horrible drumbeat of terror that hangs over the U.S. The March for Our Lives is a needed, desperate cry against that violence. But let's not pass assault weapons bans while continuing to fund military equipment for killer cops. Let's not, quote, make our schools safe while putting more cops in those schools and denying raises for teachers and support staff. Gun violence deserves a deeper conversation than is convenient for a party platform. Any response?
I like how he pointed out the failure of the drug war, and I just, it got me thinking, can we call it a drug war anymore, or is it more like a drug massacre? Cause,
you can.
Because, I mean, the millions of lives affected so far.
The death.
It's not a war. I mean, we're certainly not winning it.
The opioid crisis, now it's hitting white people just as hard as it usually actually has, but in certain corners. But now it's actually, you know, it's lowering the expected lifespan of Americans below other industrialized countries. And it's all caused to a structural level by the lack of future that many Americans have. A future that has been stolen, or rather baked into the system at large. One writer called it called what Obama did in his, under his tenure, strip mining hope. He built up the hopes of people our age and under-delivered, as well as all the other Democrats and our so-called progressive leadership. So I don't even bother saying I'm a progressive, because that's identifying a cadre of people who at best want us to be Sweden or Norway, which is a hell of a lot better as far as minimizing harm, but it isn't totally just, because there are still lots of problems there, but of course, and they aren't too different from ours. While a more utopian, futuristic, you know, future focused stance is about having a completely different set of problems, which is hard to imagine. As some critical theorists would put, it is easier to imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism. And well, the purpose of this show is to help us imagine a world after capitalism that isn't Mad Max or whatever dystopian. Because as far as sci-fi goes, the number of dystopian to utopian novels is 10 to 1. As far as what's published and whatever.
I didn't know there were utopian novels.
6 were published in the last 10 years, I guess.
Oh, wow.
To 80 dystopian. It was a little solar punk meme. Solar punk is a futurist utopian movement that doesn't have many novels under its belt as far as what it represents it. It's more of like the desire for such things. So it's kind of like backwards, in which a literary artistic movement is made out of people's desire for it, than it being kind of done almost, it's a different kind of organic process.
Where's the climax in that story? What problem are they overcoming in a utopian society?
It's usually a personal one.
Okay.
Like a relationship problem. But it's a matter of the setting being one where the problems, like I said, different set of problems. Mm-hmm. But the problems don't hinge on making rent, having cancer and needing to pay for it.
Oh, you mean like real?
A la
like
Breaking Bad or some such hit TV shows. The Wire, beyond drug war and corrupt state versus corrupt
private actors. That actually sounds like a really good story.
I have a few. And I was going to devote a different show to just solar punk and talk about that. I just want to bring it up. But actually, so I'll switch to a kind of... I mentioned the NRA is using left-wing arguments at times. And then there was like... And liberals were making fun of it, how ridiculous it was to call gun control racist. But it's not a matter of buying, you know, one or the other.
Gun control was racist in the 60s with the Black Panther movement. And
I'm literally going to reference a story from Al Jazeera.
Okay.
Terrorist media that it is. No. Al Jazeera is out of Qatar. And So it's titled Gun Control's Racist Past and Present. By Creed Newton, calls for strict gun control after mass shootings, overlooked how regulations have been used to disarm people of color. So this was published after the Las Vegas massacre earlier last year.
It's sad that we chronologically remember time by the mass shooting.
One reaction is as good as another, depending on what it is. These upgrades, so he talks about the bump stock. I'm going to start with complex history. Gun ownership is part of the fabric that makes up U.S. identity. With the right to bear arms found in our Second Amendment, adopted in 1791. But racism in gun laws predates the founding of the nation. So if you've listened to other left-leaning podcasts like Sam Cedar or whatever, like they've talked about this. Like I learned of this from them back in 09, 010. So, but for those who have never listened to any of those shows, this might be your first time. Otherwise, it's a review. So essentially earlier, the colony of Virginia had laws prohibiting slaves from owning guns. After being emancipated as a result of the Civil War, Southern slaves passed laws known as Black Codes, which, among other many other things, which disarmed and economically disabled African Americans in order to sustain enforcing white supremacy. I haven't read this often, but a point about, like, there's two kinds of racism in America, which is, you can rise to whatever level you want as long as you're far away from me. And then the other is, you can be near me, but you can't rise. You have to stay low. Which is northern racism, like the kind that existed in Albany up until now, and the South.
So keep the poverty line low. And
I mean, you see it in action, like with the people in Buckingham Pond, and like just like, oh well, we don't want poor. It becomes classism more than racism. It's like, oh, I don't like the poor people. They don't take care of their apartments. But guess what coincides with class? So then, you know, they quote an expert saying it's not really just one or the other. Saying that gun laws have never been racist is also wrong, but it's also wrong to say that all gun control is racist. Even in the case when laws are race neutral, meaning they apply to everyone, there are examples of biased enforcement. And that's one of those critiques that will come up in the third example of a Facebook post where the laws propose the gun control, like we don't want to take away their guns, says all the liberals. We just want to ban these type of guns and we want to keep them out of the hands of people we or the state has deemed dangerous. And guess who the state usually deems dangerous?
Criminals.
Who are usually called criminals?
Statistically speaking, isn't it 75% are a minority?
People of color, yeah. And even when it comes to mental illness, it is state-licensed professionals that declare who is mentally ill and who isn't. And in the past, and of course, some of the labels and the methods have changed, but let's say in the past, it was that any teenager who had any anti-authoritarian tendency or lack of respect for authority was diagnosed with being mentally ill. And now it's changed to kids who don't want to sit still in class for 4 hours at a time, or a myriad of other things, and thus they're seen as threats to a stable, sane society. But when it comes to change, it's usually from the insane. That's Foucault talking there. The marginalized, the insane are the marginalized, or people are insane because they're marginalized, either by the economy, meaning they're not granted opportunities of any kind, and etc.
So just getting back to some numbers, the incarceration rates disproportionately impact men of color. One in every 15 African-American men, one in every 36 Hispanic men are incarcerated in comparison to one in every 106 white men.
Okay.
Pretty rash numbers there, I would say.
Definitely. Yes, and to point out why that is, it is discriminating. I mean, the laws favor they're written up in a way that criminalizes what poor or black people do. For example, you get more jail time for dealing crack than coke. That's a classic example, but I'll bring it closer to home. Loitering on stoops is criminalized. You can get a ticket, you can get a citation. Loitering on stoops, you particularly sitting on stoops that don't belong to you. But who sits on stoops? The homeless looking for a place to sit because our city lacks benches. Let's say
like a good bench to me.
Let's say going to the bathroom in public. Gross, unlike detestable. But where are our public bathrooms? It's not acceptable. You know, where are people supposed to go if they don't have a home to go to? And so it's just you're criminalized just by the fact that of a situation of not being able to afford a place or being too mentally ill to work a job, which then creates a feedback loop. And thus why the people who are busking on Lark Street are also, say, the most unstable and hard to deal with. So I'm going to bring that back. So back to the article. Many point to laws passed in the turbulent 1960s when the black nationalist groups took up arms to defend their communities as an example of racist implementation. The leftist Black Panther Party, whose members carried weapons to guard against police brutality, quote-unquote invaded or occupied or stood in front of the Capitol, California Capitol Building, Sacramento, in 67. California's then-governor, Ronald Reagan, signed the Mumford Act shortly after that, prohibiting open carry of weapons in public places. The following year would see the passing of the Gun Control Act in 1968, signed by then-President Nixon. The law banned Saturday night specials, cheaply made handguns associated with crime in minority communities, as well as barring felons, the mentally ill, and others from owning firearms. Great concern. So that really worked. And so, you know, there's a great concern when black people are using arms. And in the last few minutes of this segment, I'm just going to reference, just mention that there's a book that I read a few chapters of called This Nonviolent Stuff Is Gonna Get You Killed, which is memoir, part historiography of the civil rights movement. So the subtitle is How Guns Made the Civil Rights Movement Possible. He goes through not all of, but prime examples of when guns were used in the civil rights movement, particularly you were not going to register to vote and not end up being lynched unless you had a pistol on you. And Martin Luther King himself carried a pistol, and many others remarked that his home was like an arsenal. There was a group that, along with all of his organizing, was the Deacons for Defense, and they would carry shotguns to stand guard outside every venue they were at, because it is not only possible but likely that the Klan would come by and firebomb their butts, as they did to children in churches. But when you make it possible for a Klansman to lose their life in trying to harass, terrorize blacks in the South, it was essential to the movement being able to actually exist, because that's what had changed, that you had all of these black people, people of color who had served in World War II and Korea, and they knew how to use guns, and they knew, and they had that same kind of almost conservative ethic, that gun ownership is part of being a citizen. Not a matter of protecting yourself from tyranny at most, but just the ability to be on equal terms,
to have civil liberties
with those with more power than you, to equalize the physical violence you could exert. That's kind of what deterrence is usually about. As long as everyone has an equal amount of ability to exert violence, that's usually, you know, it's usually the conservative, the actual conservative way of thinking about geopolitics, you know, and that's what the disarming treaties are about. You know, conservatives can take them up as long as it's a matter of equal access. But in that case, then every country should have a nuclear weapon as a deterrent. And that's, I kind of like that idea, but at the same time, it should be a world without any nuclear weapons, and we could go more the Superman 4 route and just kind of disarm them all eventually, but it should be planned out that we should do that instead of just piecemeal, which is what it's been.
What America needs is a Superman. That way,
we can't wait for Superman, as certain movies have pointed out. We got to do it ourselves.
I know we're running back on the break here, but
oh yeah,
there is a great firsthand rendition of that Black Panther's Supreme Court decision back in 1970s by Radiolab. If anyone's interested, it's called The Gun Show.
Back. That was Rihanna being pretty political, actually. That's why I like that song called American Oxygen.
Rihanna's really political, actually. She's she's Bajan. She's from the island of Barbados. And
right.
She's very she's a very big activist on her island. She actually owns the only fast food restaurant on the whole island. It's a delicious
fast food restaurant, though.
Yeah.
Not chain, of course, but
chain.
Pretty big island, though, isn't it?
It's about 90 square miles. Uh-huh. It's the southernmost.
I was just watching a video about the most densely populated island in the world, which has like 100 and so families on it, and it's about the size of a soccer field.
Okay.
It's a very strange place. Interesting urbanism there.
Yeah, but that restaurant is called Chevette's, and it serves fried food and ice cream.
Oh, man. So if you're ever in Barbados.
Yeah, they have about three on the whole island.
Pound the Alarm, which was the song where she recorded there. Okay, so in this segment, we're going to do something a little spicier, which in internet parlance means it's more transgressive, may upset people. I'm going to preface this with a few things.
Hot, hot, hot.
First, this might count as all hearsay, things to check on your own. This seems... Oh, no. Actually, no. This Facebook post cites sources. So a meme is usually when someone says something that needs evidence. Extraordinary claims need extraordinary evidence. You should provide it. And if someone doesn't, usually the meme is to throw up a big, in quotes, citation needed. So usually most things that come out of alt-right conspiracy, you know, like most right-wing smears of the leaders of the new movement for gun control. And I did notice from the speech of the male quote-unquote crisis actor. I'll mention his name in this post. So this post is more, I'm not going to quote, I'm going to let it lie. The name, if you look up via our Facebook page, I list everything that I read. So I guess it's Serafina J. Thompson. The name is not too meaningful. but this is just kind of a listing of problematic things, particularly about the two faces of the March for Our Lives movement, which is probably in poor taste. I'm going to do it. That's why it's spicy. Usually you hear from the right, they're smearing them, and the NRA smears, and usually I see post after post about that. And so here's to come along to kind of give a little balance, some left-wing smearing, or rather criticism, or pointing out things that are, as we say, problematic. Things that don't disqualify them from being public figures. We support them in that regard. We have solidarity with the pain, as the other statement said. We appreciate the pain that they're in, and we feel it too. We know how bad things are. We do want to critique the system. We want massive change, and we do want to unelect, and maybe if in some circles replace them with Green Party people that have a much more, depending on the person, nuanced take on guns. Usually we actually just leave it up to people as far as the Green Party is concerned. So some of the older activists are of that framework of using state power for the common good. And some of us kind of newbie people, we're a bit more libertarian in that regard. We want decentralized state power. And that means not legislating what people do and what they can own. So this new movement, March for Our Lives, I'm disappointed to see a lot of you latching onto it. Nearly overnight, Emmett Gonzalez and David Hogg became the iconic face of the movement, their children, and what's more, survivals of a horrific trauma, which makes them extremely sympathetic figures. The advantage, and by extension the danger, in being a sympathetic figure is that no one looks into your background. It's largely been ignored that the March for Our Lives has a white supremacist platform, referring to gun control hurting black and brown communities. It's largely on not just gun control, but all of its auxiliary issues as well, pushing policies and attitudes that have actively harmed and continue to actively harm people of color, poor, neurodivergent, and queer folk in disproportionately large numbers, from open state oppression to the school-to-prison pipeline, the wonky juvie practices to selective enforcement to profiling and many other issues. The fact that they have been blatantly infiltrated by the police, or openly work with the police, is largely lauded and celebrated instead of condemned. And the racist origins of the march's funding has been ignored too. Y'all didn't think this was free, did you? Which came from ex-Mayor Bloomberg's nonprofit, Everytown. And for context, Bloomberg was the man who just a few years ago recently and proudly pushed for the racist stop and frisk policy in New York City and has openly detained, and he's also 11th, about between 9th and 11th richest man in the world. I always like to point that out when mentioning him. All of these white supremacist roots and more have largely been ignored almost in perfect totality by the march's supporters. Moving on to the personalities, not to be seen as direct attacks, but it's hard not to. Emma Gonzalez herself comes from a slave driving plantation owning ex-bourgeois Cuban family. And David Hogg is the son of an FBI agent. And no, I'm not being a conspiracy theorist. Look it up. This is public and reported knowledge. David was in the news recently for defending his dad's work when Trump took to Twitter to attack the FBI a while back. They both live in an upper middle class school district that largely shields them via class privilege from the issues and struggles that normally radicalize working class people. And this, quote, is who the liberals have chosen to attach to and uplift on this issue. Not the countless dying, marginalized, working-class peoples that have been protesting these issues going decades back. It's really quite ingenious, though, with Gonzalez and Hogg being children, and not just children, but children of a horrific and very public trauma, all of this makes them very hard to attack. Sounds like a right-wing talking point, doesn't it? Not to mention Gonzalez's ethnicity automatically activates white guilt in the more elitist liberal circles, so talking about a particular group, the ones pushing this movement and giving it platform, that is. The amount of social capital these two are accruing relatively overnight is incredible. Some of this stuff, it does sound very simplistic. I'm going to admit that. And I'm just, this is to activate the conversation. It's like this hegemonic wave is sweeping the nation and we're powerless to stop it. And it is mortifying to witness happening in live action. Marginalized children have been dying since long before any of us reading this were alive. We, as a society, have ignored it, until the issue marginally, no pun, affected a random, mostly white corner of middle-class suburbia that bore a feel-good movement that was openly infiltrated from day one by the very people perpetuating this violence in the first place. And now, referring to white supremacists, when it is... and now, as a society, choose to get excited about this issue when it is backed by white supremacists and middle-class kids? What's that say about the kind of society we are? This is the kind of liberalism in America today, and it's why you won't catch actual leftists within 1,000 feet of the sham of movement. It deserves to be called out at every turn. What these kids are doing and how our society is treating them compared to others doing similar work is indefensible, unconscionable, and should be rebuked, not celebrated at every given opportunity. Edit. I got so excited about everything else that I forgot to include the parts about both Gonzalez and Hogg encouraging each other on Twitter with multiple cited quotes from President Reagan while they moved to demonize mentally ill people in the name of their new movement. Honestly, everything about this movement is problematic enough. We could all go on about it for days. I can't keep adding more stuff, blah, blah, blah. P.S. Some comrades are posting some good links on the history of racism, oppression, and alternatives to state policing in this thread. I am going to start collecting them here, starting with the awesome and radical kids in Chicago who we all should have been listening to in the first place, who have a platform almost completely opposite to the Parklanders' platform. Feel free to private message me for relevant sources and links. For example, No Cop Academy, Chicago Youth Stage Die-In in City Hall to demand. Oh, okay. No, this is just a listing of the sources, which is in a way that is exactly like I do it. Thoughts?
Is it weird to point out the irony that the FBI kid, Tom, like even the FBI couldn't protect the school shooting or prevent this? With the kids so close.
There have been other instances of white supremacists shooting up public places where the FBI was either tracking them
notified,
and they did nothing. And this is what is meant when revolutionary left uses chants like cops and Klan go hand in hand. Mm-hmm. It's not that it's the same membership, but there's a allowance and tolerance that white boys will be white boys, but black boys are a dangerous existential threat to public safety and public health. And so they need to all be jailed or helped. And help comes in interesting ways. It's in the same week as the March for Our Lives, there was another black man gunned down by police, this time in his own backyard. The police thought he was holding a gun or something, but it was a household item because it was his backyard. And what he did was he exited his home to see what all the noise in the back was. And they shot him 20 times.
Are you not allowed to have a gun in your backyard?
Not if you're of color, no. Because then you're scary and you're a threat. Not if he was white. And although there are examples of police shooting white folks of various types, they're usually very poor and marginalized themselves, perhaps mentally ill. It's been noted on other posts that people on the autistic spectrum are shot by the police regularly because police don't know how to handle these neurotypical people. And those are the people classified as mentally ill. They can't have a gun, and they're on the danger list, the threat list. And And that's kind of what, and that, so that's what this is getting at, this long ass, this long post. So that's very salty. Yeah.
Speaking of racism, one of my favorite.
Yeah, right in the mic.
One of my favorite white supremacist talking points or rebuttals to the civil rights movement was that Rosa Parks was selected as a she was. I mean, there were other people that
She was.
Yeah, and there was.
There was a teenager at the same time who's there also who would have been better.
There was a careful, careful branding and organization.
There was public relations that work,
And she was this sympathetic character. And there's nothing about organization and I hate to use the phrase branding. Mm-hmm. There's nothing about that makes the civil rights movement any less legitimate.
Of course, it was a sit-in. It was an organized direct action in which Rosa Parks was one of several people arrested. And she was simply chosen to be the spokesperson because she was a working woman and not, say, a teenager who was actually the real start of it as being she was the one who refused to get off the bus and thus inspired the need for the direct action.
Yeah.
So that's why she should be the face because she is the one who really started it. But she was a teenager, young, and thus at the time seen as being somewhat right. It would be seen as illegitimate from the moderate liberals that the movement needed them to be on their side. But as Malcolm X would put, the moderate liberal is about as dangerous as the Klan to me. They're both against my rights, and they're dangerous as far as the way they act towards me, and that has not changed at all.
But the reason I bring that up is that the
20 seconds left.
If this was all being organized by George Soros, if it would Emma Gonzalez and David Hogg, they've received a lot of scrutiny because they're...
Well, it doesn't have to be Soros. It can be Bloomberg.
Or Bloomberg,
which is interesting. The reality is it is a billionaire orchestrating it. But it's Bloomberg, not Soros. Interesting, right? So this is the Three Left Show, the show that prepares for a post-capitalist future, and that represents peak transit. The
peak transit. Let's go into that.
Okay. It was literally
Peak
transit.
Oh. I thought you were talking about like Pete Moss or
I'm going for intros and outros that are based on memes that I encounter every day.
No,
So there's a Facebook group called this is what it's called. It's New Urbanist Memes for Transit Oriented Teens. And so there's this constant refrain of people posting something like that's cool and saying, is this peak transit?
Yeah.
It's like a dog riding the bus. Peak transit?
I still want to go.
This is peak transit,
I still want to go back to Pete Transit, like Pete Moss moving.
Pete Moss, that was the primary fuel source in the Renaissance era. Not Moss, but like Pete. The carbon and peat bogs, and but that was completely strip mined by the time coal became
relevant,
needed to use. But it was a major because there's a lot of carbon in there.
Yeah.
That's right. So it was in the discussion of an article of how we could go back to farming like this. It takes a decade for it to really form in these peat bogs, but you set it up like tree farms. And then you can, but it's like there's always so much energy you can take out of it, but it's working with an ecosystem and not
we're not mining,
demolishing it.
Yeah.
But all the peat bogs in, say, Holland were completely strip mined and that's kind of why Holland is so low lying in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
like the 20 feet of topsoil was removed because it was so carbon rich and used in the furnaces that kept their industry afloat, which made them the powerhouse that they were economically. Wow. It's contributed because wealth isn't just generated from just trading. It is generated from making stuff.
Well, yeah, you need something to trade.
And that's usually something missing from the neoliberal equation of, well, we just need people to spend money. Where does the money come from? It has to be made somewhere. And
we invent money, and we could talk about some other time.
I'm talking about wealth, the actual value of things. So the next segment is then back to me. Like, if I was posting Facebook posts, which I normally don't because I do like – I have a wide-ranging social circle – but I do find some of their attitudes a little insufferable.
Is this our new segment?
Dan's
rants?
It could be, but there, it's not like a unified, like, kind of a commentator rant, like, on Fox News or something.
Could you make a rant and then me and Eric will comment on it almost like on a Facebook wall?
Maybe, but it's mostly just me complaining about various things. So, like, there was a post about from the March for Our Lives Matter, and it was, like, lots of pictures of kids with signs, and... someone said, like, this kid has won the sign game. I'm like, now it's a game to you? I thought this was serious business. What is it? You know,
I feel like he could came up with something a little more original, like arts and crafts let out earlier. I mean, you know, if you're going
No, this was someone supportive of the kids marching.
Oh, okay.
But, like, you know, and I'm supportive of it, too, to the extent of...
it's not a game.
Get it out of the... well, that, and get it out of the way now when you're young. Learn that protesting is ineffective, as Michael White pointed out in his book, End of Protest. He wrote it, like, a year after Occupy. Occupy was all about how protest... the protest segment was actually the least effective. If we just kept all our energy into building these camps where our little islands of anarchy, that would probably have, you know, been able to grow, especially if we were under the radar. But they were really effective as far as recruiting tools into, you know, radicalizing people because we got so much national news attention. So it's like, you know, those one of those catch-22s. And the national media attention was what brought the state down on us because we were actually radicalizing a lot of people with our, we prefer not to play this existing game, this game of asking politicians, whether they be Democrat or Republican, to fix our problems for us.
So the idea is that protests don't really work because
they listen to millionaires.
They're too, on the system. You have to get your walking papers. You have to be off the street by 10 o'clock, you know.
That's the on the level. Yeah, the on the level regulations. And then the macro is that what many people already know is that our political system is based on money. Money is political power. People in the streets is not political power. Money is.
Numbers isn't.
So you either need to make the money not matter, which is like what moving to a new economy is about, making the money not matter. The money that's held by the 1%.
Brought to you by blockchain.
Right. it's great to bring that up each time I mention that stuff, because that's, you know, these technologies, these new experiments, is how we kind of move towards that post-capitalist future.
So realistically, the real way to protest is to interrupt the money flow. So rather than... have
a
walk,
yeah,
you'd have to really,
or the pipelines or the flow of resources into the hands of the military,
almost follow the Europeans and blocking, really mess some transit up.
Oh yeah, or South Americans are more, even more better at this, the blocking of highways, you know. And here in America, Black Lives Matter are so chided for blocking highways. Well, I chide them because they're just doing it with their bodies, and yeah, you can get run over. They should be blocking it with barricades. They should be setting fires like they do in South America. Every 100 yards, you set a new fire, and so it takes days to clean up, not an hour. An hour to arrest you, an hour to clean up. No, you should make it so that it takes days of choking commercial activity.
Dan, who has time?
That hurts people in the mouth.
I gotta get home to watch my nightly
newscast. Well, if we're gonna be serious, if I mean a serious revolutionary, as it were, and not just, you know, being behind social
media.
So
it takes time. It takes energy. It takes
commitment,
solidarity.
Right. Having a community to back you up so that when you do something dangerous and like that, you do have a community to back you up in various ways, whether it's with bail support when you are arrested or if, you know, literal political, you know, people power can be real power, but it has to develop in ways that are actually confronting money and the economy and the political status quo and not trying to work within it. So that's why I kind of poo-poo all of those other lines of action and organizing, though political campaigns like the ones I participated in and will continue to, the Green Party ones, are about outreach. And I'm usually only participating in them to make sure that we are outreaching to people who have not voted, are not voting, and have a populist leaning because they are sick and tired of being sick and tired. And they may not know exactly what is making them sick and tired, but I mean, they have an idea about the personalities they don't like.
Is that a Kanye quote?
No, it's from Network.
Okay. It's also
sick and tired about sick and tired. Come on.
Back to your Dan.
Network, also rants. A movie with a lot of great rants. Let's see. Another was the... oh, yeah. So the need for public political speeches. So this is something that is needed and good. And, you know, in Albany, we activist community in the scene that I'm, you know, part of, we organize rallies all the time, but we usually don't get a lot of numbers, usually 100 at most. And that's our scene, our community, the people who have free time, usually middle class leaning, not a lot of working, not too many working people. And if it is, it's when I have a day off. It's when, you know, I've taken the day off, which a lot of people can't do. But I noticed, so in the last 2 years, there's been 3 mass rallies held in front of the Capitol of liberals or liberal-leaning people. There's the Women's March, the March for Science, and now the March for Our Lives. Their marches were always incredibly short, by the way, most 1 square block. So calling them, they're more rallies than marches. I don't like calling them marches. But they marched around the Capitol, which is literally half a block. And I'm like, that doesn't feel like you're doing, how do these people feel good about that? It's like, it's barely a job. It's barely
like
a walk.
A roundabout.
It's like a roundabout.
A roundabout for
science.
Yeah,
it's truly, it's performative. That's the word to use. This is we're performing a march. A real march is to somewhere. A real march is to block something, you know.
We rally here at point A.
But then you had all these
to point B.
These concerns of like, oh, some of us can't walk that far, and like, then they only walk part way, like, you know, and it's like, you know, have the kids actually walk somewhere, you know? And when I was young, I participated in, like, there's the Martin Luther King March, which kind of goes through Lincoln Park, and it is in fact a linear route. It's very short, but at least it's a route instead of just a loop around the block, which was the March for Science. I was there. I played my saxophone in place because I didn't feel like walking around the block.
Maybe they.
I performed. I performed because it's a performative action to be out for science and not, you know, lobby, actually physically lobby, you know. People should learn how to do these things.
We're dealing with scientists, Dan. Maybe they just thought it was more scientific to end at the same spot that they started.
I would like to hear their arguments for that.
I'm assuming they thought it was ergonomically relevant to, you know, that way you don't have to bus people back and forth.
So
God forbid you walk farther.
Yeah, I mentioned rhetoric as far as saying that gun control is racist. Which makes them feel really look really silly, considering how racist they are. But then you have actual radical left wingers like Killer Mike, rapid, strong Bernie supporter during the 2016 election, and then he appeared on NRA TV to make kind of a promo for them, stating the left wing argument against gun control, that it hurts black and brown people more than anyone, that this doesn't prevent mass shootings, because what causes mass shootings are material conditions, not what the regulations on guns are.
Material conditions being state of wealth. I find it ironic that a bunch of white guys sitting around saying gun control is racist, and that
it is really silly. And then of course then,
or just saying these guys are being racist towards us.
And
after
and,
year,
and then of course then it puts it in the minds with their let's see what to call it. And when I say liberal, I'm referring to moderate. So maybe I should use the word moderate, and that would be clear.
Or mibral.
Okay.
Because we can make up words.
Yeah, but
no, I like moderate
mibral
better.
Yeah, but that's what I'm talking about. Like, so, in case this is the first time you've listened, three lefts. We're left of Democrats. We're left of Bernie-crats, progressives. We're the radical left, made up of anarchist socialists.
We're outside of the can of soup.
Can of soup, sure. And if you're using like the, what do you call it, the two-dimensional political compass at politicalcompass.org, and I encourage anyone to take that, and that always kind of opens your eyes to the possibilities of what your actual affiliation might be, party or otherwise, we're in this Southwest quadrant. So there are some Facebook groups that talk about like rebranding, like since calling ourselves the left or the radical left is still really, really vague. Say we're the Southwesterners or we're...
I think it's still odd that we have this political scale that's on a linear...
Two-dimensional line. A number line.
Yeah, where...
We could give people numbers.
I mean, yeah, we could, realistically, but where does it fall? I mean, I feel like it's got to be more of a 3D scale. Like, I like the idea of the Southwest.
And some people's way of making it more nuanced is to then bend the line and make it the horseshoe.
Or maybe splits.
So instead of going off that weird tangent, I'm going to prepare a new...
I watched it on the TV. Machine guns fire towards the ground. I watched the people run. Helicopter gunship strafing the street. I watched them lining up the bodies in the Baghdad heat. They say these leaks had consequences, and I must agree. When I saw them fire on the children, it affected me. I thought, what if I were wearing the other shoe? If I had a hammer, what would I do? Seems so obvious. There are people down there. And right here in Queensland, there's an army base. And there's a helicopter gunship just sitting in place. There's a time for watching. There's a time to act. It's just gonna kill more children if it remains intact. I am just one person, but you are two. If you had a hammer, what would you do? If you had a hammer, what would you do?
So now I'm looking for the next story, and I think I will go into my paper one, actually, unless one of you...
I love the newspaper. I'm a big fan of...
So this is not just any newspaper. This is an anarchist newspaper called The Slingshot, which has been produced for a good few decades now, completely free. You can find a copy at the Social Justice Center. There's about six there. We should definitely get more and then put them in the library and such, but so it is.
Is this a weekly?
It's not. It is quarterly, meaning okay. they're 4 a year published. So I'm holding the spring issue for 2018. And so definitely go to we've ended our discussion on guns for the time being. Obviously, we were talking about guns and everything else.
Slingshots.
Slingshot is what it's called. And this is an anarchist analysis of Star Wars Episode 8. So let's just go around on our feelings and thoughts on it if you have seen it. Have you seen Star Wars 8?
I'm grossly ignorant.
Okay, that's fine.
I which one is Star Wars Episode 8?
The Last Jedi. The recent one.
I fell asleep.
Wow. Yeah, not a good endorsement.
I have a sleeping disorder.
You do? I didn't know you're an narcissist.
No, I just fall asleep during movies.
During movies that you find boring. I liked it more than Force Awakens. I don't know if I'm in a minority or just in a silent majority that actually liked all the changes, and I'm disappointed that J.J. Abrams is going to be put back in charge for the last one, or the third of the new trilogy. I liked all the changes made, and I actually found it more interesting, which makes it more entertaining for me. So it's using Star Wars Episode 8 as a launching off point, and you don't need to know too much about the movie. It doesn't reference too many explicit things. It's more of a breakdown of Sith and Jedi. The key difference between the Jedi and the Sith is the difference between existential, experimental, and authoritarian teaching styles. The Sith teach through authoritarian obedience, with apprentices unwavering obeying the dictates of masters who lie and manipulate them. Rather than asking questions of those more powerful than them, the Sith either obey an authority unquestioningly or murder and replace it with themselves. It is this type of pattern that replicates empire. It is a pattern that would tempt revolutionaries to merely throw rebellions, a pattern that tempts revolutionaries into directing their energy toward narrow visions that are simply regime changes rather than engaging in true revolutionary overhauls to the system. It is because of that Sith spirituality lends itself so acutely to empire, the building of structures for the sake of replicating a structure, rather than the well-being of those populated by them. If I pause and use a different word, it's because this article, this piece is using a academic term that has, like, the reason for using academic terms that, say, go over, say, the layman's head, or rather, what is the utility of academic terms? They usually mean multiple things at once, while a word that is part of, say, a ninth grader's vocabulary is that they usually mean one thing at a time. So I use population. Populated means one thing. They use a different word that means a bunch of things. The Jedi are about learning things organically. They hold on to the names they were given at their births, and their journeys as individuals are woven intricately into their training. Jedi Masters don't attempt to divert their claim to mastery to some abstract system, but rather embody it. Meaning at times a Jedi Master's personal truth and personal experience will, by necessity, cloud their judgment. And the Jedi Masters let their judgment be clouded as such. They let themselves make mistakes because they are letting themselves be specific people with actual specific circumstances that are meaningful. They retain their connection to those very personal circumstances and never, like the Sith, attempt to erase them. And that is why a true Jedi is always ever a revolutionary, without ever meaning to be, as their very existence posits itself as a challenge to empire. When a Jedi is turned, something terrible happens to them in the way they use the Force. One might say that they lose themselves to the Force, or at least the social power it grants them. And rather than defending what they love with it, defending what makes them who they are, they find the deployment of the Force eclipses them, subverting their being. True mastery isn't about doing things correctly. It is about how you direct your attention. The Force might be thought of as a metaphor for many things. Religious Star Wars fans think it is God. I think of it as social power. Systemized social power in the Foucauldian sense.
I'll gloss over it. And then it goes into some quotes from about Hegel, T.S. Eliot. I'm going to skip ahead.
So when they say Sith, they're not talking about Sith gender, right?
Nope.
They mean...
there aren't enough women Sith, but there are some, many in the expanded universe, though. But that's here nor there. But it would be nice to see some female Sith in the last one, maybe.
Yeah, maybe they'll be neutral. Sorry, gender neutral.
Yeah, I mean, there were more women in the Rebellion, and in, there were some women in, represented on the in the First Order, but not a lot. You know, it's it seems to be male-dominated and such. But
yeah, I saw that my first female general in not the last Star Wars movie, but...
Was there one in Force Awakens?
Yeah, in the Force Awakens, yeah. It was...
The Disney animated show Rebels has plenty of female characters on both sides. I really like that one more than the movies ever could be. Why? Because TV allows you to tell more stories and go deeper and have arcs
that are
more than just 2 hours long.
I would just think in Hollywood, more female actors would be more liability for the producers in these Hollywood films.
Hold on to that, because that comes back towards the end of this. Let's see if I can jump into a little bit good part here. Among the Jedi and their rebel counterparts, individual lives matter. Among the Sith and their Imperial counterparts, individuals are killed for failing because their lives don't matter. To be among the Imperials and the Sith is to have been made into a type of human commodity, into a faceless, interchangeable thing, and publicly murdering their own who fail in a way of rectifying everyone's interchangeability within the Empire, like cogs in a machine. Of showcasing to each other the degree to which within the Empire, individual lives don't matter. To those of the dark side, only raw power matters. They see the talent rather than the person. They are focused only on properly placing that talent within the pyramid-shaped hierarchy of their organizational structure and have no grasp of what it means to have a personal experience as an individual. Which is why they so frequently deface individuals with masks and new names, erasing the individual's past and future, erasing that person's journey and any markers that may allow them to construct the narrative of being on a journey, and rather reduce existence to an ever-present state of completing tasks and obeying or destroying your superiors and subordinates. The dark side doesn't afford its adherents things like sisters, lovers, and comrades. The only antidote to this despair is extreme obedience. Vader knelt before the Emperor, even as he commanded him to murder his own son. But in a refusal of the ancient story of Abraham, Vader's unwavering faith in the Force, for the sake of the Force, is shattered by the command to end his son's life, and his humanity is restored. As people on the internet pointed out, the new film redeems the prequels, as unwatchable as they are. I find them less so, by the way. By reframing them as a time when the Jedi Order became corrupted with a pseudoscience of midichlorian counts, overshadowing the spiritual underpinnings of using the Force.
I love when people on the internet criticize like the Star Wars movies. Like, you think you could have made a better one? Do you think you could have?
Some try, and I've seen some fan-made Star Wars films, which, you know, never longer than 20 minutes, I guess, and they're not bad. They're okay.
Okay.
But amateur productions, you know.
Do you remember the...
I watched one in full, and it was about two students of Vader who were falling in love. And since Sith also aren't really allowed to love, or they have to, like, you know, be individuals, they chose to run away, and the movie is them kind of fighting a bounty hunter sent after them.
I think I've seen that movie, actually, that short. It's a really good one. It's in the wood scene, right?
It's probably the only good one, perhaps.
Yeah,
but,
yeah, I think it won some fan awards.
Let's...
I love the classic. I don't remember back in the day when the internet first became pretty big, the one kid... With the double
Star
sabers,
Wars kid.
The Star Wars kid.
That's
is
called.
He was one of the big, one of the first internet memes out there, I would say. At least one of the most entertaining ones.
It's a case of he didn't know he was being taped, so his performance, quote unquote, that was only meant really for himself, was authentic. So, like, there's kind of, there's different kind of memes, and sometimes you laugh at someone for how authentic they are, and sometimes you laugh because of how inauthentic they are. Mm-hmm. Like, and that's kind of the difference between laughing with someone and laughing at someone. Like, when you two gentlemen are doing your comedy, and you know, if I'm laughing because you're being real and authentic, and I'm not seeing what you're doing as being cliche or fake or forced. And something is forced when something is inauthentic.
Yeah.
So, and the same goes for movies and whatnot. As it's relatable, and that's what makes some movies, the art's subjective is, does it relate to you? If it doesn't, then you're not going to be able to connect and see as realistic, or you're just going to nitpick about how, you know, like, there's some YouTubers that make fun of they complain about cartoons when they're absurdist. And there's a right way, there's a good, better way of doing absurd humor, like SpongeBob does. But then there are cartoons that don't. But it's like, well, they're still going to chuckle out at me because I can recognize absurdist humor for what it is. Like My Python. And no, that's also, Netflix has secured the rights to show that.
Wow, that's a big deal. That's breaking.
There's so many people that...
Why didn't we start with that?
...don't know the standard jokes of Monty Python. I have watched all of Flying Circus via library copies, which I guess are not supplied anymore. Bummer for that. And they were from the main branch, they're not there anymore.
I'm assuming Netflix probably bought them.
I don't know what the hell happened. I don't know what happened. So I'm going to continue. This is going. I like this a lot.
Maybe just someone never returned them, and there's an outstanding library.
To turn someone from the dark side back to the light is to make their life matter again. To give them an identity with relationships and channels of meaning that matter to them and others. The rebellion offers no ready-made hierarchy between strategy and feelings. So at times, two groups within the movement find themselves at odds, talking past each other. One group says, "This is how it feels." The other group saying, "This is how it should be done." This type of social messiness is tied to the basic human expression that they fight to maintain space for. The fact that such discussions can happen.
I mean, they're both saying important things, but they're just
in different ways
not being heard.
Mm-hmm. Or they're not listening to each other, perhaps. The Buddha is sometimes credited with saying, "Be your own light." But to do that means you don't get to have the sort of easy answers that only others can give. This is why Jedi Masters do not demand that their apprentices obey unwaveringly, but rather, as Master Yoda says to Master Luke after setting fire to the ancient Jedi test, spoilers, we are what we grow beyond. That is the true burden of all masters. Master Yoda also tells us that fear is what turns people towards the dark, and this is what we see time and again in the lives of those who come to the ways of the Sith. Wink, wink. True, sure. The Jedi also have fear and insecurity. They are plagued by it, but the Jedi manage their fear and insecurity as best they can, sometimes making wild, irrational decisions propelled by it. But the Sith have a very different relationship with fear. They vanish it by making themselves so powerful that they no longer have to have fear and insecurity. In doing so, they erase themselves, giving in to the dark side. So where I left off was... that, you know, in trying to, you know, how the Jedi and the Sith face fear differently. And the Sith face fear by destroying themselves, putting them behind masks, like Kylo Ren did, and then he gave up his mask. Let's see. Fear that you aren't enough. Giving into the dark side is guided by fear. Fear that you are not enough. Leading to the donning of a mask. You become fear itself. This embracing of fear to escape fear, of turning yourself into a thing to be feared, as a way of avoid grappling with your own fear. It is at the heart of any gesture towards fascism, of any turn towards the dark side, towards the rigid lines of empire and colonialism, and as they exist in our own world today. It is self-erasure at its deepest form, and it is this that guides members of our species toward organized, machine-inspired behavior that destroys all living things. Like the Sith, the Jedi sometimes do conceal the truth from their apprentices. old Ben lies to Luke about his father being dead. And Luke conceals the truth about Ben Solo's turn from Rey.
Wait, Luke's dad's dead?
Jeez. Well, that's what Ben Kenobi said. He said his father was dead.
Oh, okay.
That's what made it a twist when Vader tells him that he is his father.
Luke.
Okay. Behind his mask. These lies come from the very flawed yet deeply human place of wanting to protect others and perhaps oneself from the truth. Does that make these lies any better than the types the lies Sith tell? Lies inspired by the desire to increase the power and obedience of the apprentice? In words of more relativist DJ? Maybe. Luke's end was so perfect for him. Yoda had long chided Luke for always watching the horizon, never focused on where he is, what he is doing. In his final act, Luke's not-there-ness achieves perfection, because Luke was never supposed to be there or here now, or any of that 1970s randrass crap. Luke Skywalker's job was to be a symbol, to direct people's attention, to direct it in all the wrong places, or in the right ones, depending on who you are. Yes, Luke Skywalker is a commodity, and what Episode 8 does so well is it acknowledges that. But Luke Skywalker, at least within the story world of the films, is a revolutionary commodity. As Jedi Master Gil Scott Heron taught us, the revolution will not be televised. But until Capital fails as hard as Darth Weinstein did last October, perhaps the now embodying the revolutionary commodity is the most we can hope to achieve. Hashtag occupy the spectacle. Even if the police, guided by the lifeless logic of Capital, marched in and crushed our seedlings with their bulldozers as they did at Occupy the Farm in 2012 and 2013, and even if they fence in People's Park and harm and murder peaceful protesters as they did in 69 in the early 90s, and even if the FBI breaks into the Slingshot Loft and steals our computers as they did in 09, even as they strike us down in so many ways, we only grow stronger the more they tighten their grip. Well, you get the idea. The rebellion could be wiped off the map. We have been here before. But as long as children are born who can feel their inherent worth as human beings and refuse to let anyone convince them otherwise, the struggle will live on. Water is sacred. Occupy everything. Demand nothing. Black Lives Matter. May the farm be with you. May 1,000 parks bloom. Reactions? Is there anything in that like that wasn't comprehensible? Because I could go over like each like little bits and kind of reinterpret them for whoever hasn't read any critical theory, which I've done a little, and I'll probably like cover bits of that on the show, but in really small bites.
As somebody who's learning in real time just now the difference between Jedi and Sith,
mm-hmm.
you know, and how it relates to
the world that we live in.
Yeah, and anarchism, whether economically or
politically,
mm-hmm. I just reminded of something in there's a Taoist proverb about the difference between a poor ruler and an okay one and a truly competent one, which is that a poor ruler is feared and despised, a good one is beloved, but when he's really doing his job, the people don't even know he exists.
Oh, yeah, the invisible one.
And anarchism, when it isn't equated as it colloquially, popularly is, as
chaos.
Yeah.
But actually, it is organization.
That comes from this pervasive sort of order. Like everywhere you go in the universe, triangles, angles, and add up to 180 degrees. And that without the. Without the interference of government, everyone,
or state power, particularly, or just hierarchical power, because you know you could, as right wing libertarians could do, you remove state power, but you still have corporate power. You still have the power of the billionaires, and that's kind of like they're one and the same at the moment. Do billionaires have the power of money without the government? And then it kind of becomes a, what do you tear down first? And usually left-wing anarchists, like the perspectives represented in Slingshot, is that you take down both at the same time. One will rebuild the other if given this room, which is kind of what happened between the second half of the 20th century and continues today, is, you know, the labor movement kind of took away some economic power from the super rich, but then maintained state power and let it grow with the military-industrial complex. And now we have a massive war industry that apparently our economy depends on. But, and that's why the gun industry can't be downsized. We, you know, we could ban guns, but we still have massive weapons industries. We provide the most weapons in the world today, across the world. And of course, whether it's, doesn't matter what president it is, weapons deals are being made to Saudi Arabia and other human rights violators. Israel, which, oh, I wanted to, oh, yeah, that's right. We're out of time, but I guess in the next episode we'll cover one that I came across. Oh, yeah, I'll tease it. It was an article about old Jews being afraid of and panicking about young Jews who weren't supporting Israel anymore. Like
next
myself.
Time on the Three Left Show.
Like myself. And it's funny to me, because you got Schumer and these other old Westchester conservatives, neocons, that are like, where did we go wrong? And it's a simple answer. You're fascist. That's where you went wrong. And you support a ethno state. I mean, if we don't like it here, we're not going to like it there. Just because it's our ethno state, it's still going to have those terrible, terrible consequences of genocide and madness and imprisonment and what have you. An apartheid state, which is what Israel is. So, plug for the BDS movement. Don't buy a pair of Muhammad's. That's a start. So what else? We got 10 minutes left, actually. And I don't have... Oh, yeah, I have a little thing to plug. So this is from Waging Nonviolence. This is a quick little story here. And it's resistance-themed board games. So very light topic. But in order to imagine a new world, a different economy, a future for ourselves that isn't dystopia, as so many movies that just come out one after the other, as beautiful as they can be, it's still dystopia.
So a board game... unlike Monopoly, that has a capitalistic idea
ethos,
behind it.
Ideology, yes.
Or the game of life, which is, although practical,
life
extremely...
is a ladder and a line, and you follow the line, and it has these steps, and then you die.
Yes. So back to these more utopic board games.
So just a little history. The Monopoly was based off of a board game called Cooperation, and it was about co-ops, or rather, it was based on a board game that was more explicit about teaching kids about the exploitative nature of property ownership, of private property ownership, mind you. Property ownership based on deeds and collecting rent and not use. You know, if you are a owner-occupier, that is a much different set of circumstances and material condition than the company that owns thousands of units and so on. So, but here's a new generation of board games created by, I'll go into it, I guess, but, let's say, Kickstarter campaigns and then little indie developers on the fringes. I've got technical issue here. All right. 7 resistance themed board games to strengthen your injustice fighting skills. And this is from Waging Nonviolence, a site for people powered news and analysis. Are you exhausted personally and politically by the current state of the world? Or yes, just in need of a distraction, something to lighten up the remaining days of winter? Here's a recommendation: play board games. I'm not talking about Risk or Chutes and Ladders, even though they can be fun. I want to make a pitch for exploring a rather broad category of resistance-inspired games. So let's just scroll down here. One's called Rise Up, Game of People and Power, from Tesla Games, TESA, otherwise known as Toolbox for Education and Social Action. Mouthful. The game develops tension as the system fights back when players draw a system card after each turn. Yeah, just explain rules. I'm not going to go into it. Just that, just bring to attention that these things exist. Another is the actual Monopoly response by Tessa. Co-opoly, the game of cooperatives. Everyone wins or everyone loses.
That's realistic.
Certainly is.
It sure beats the I win and everyone loses approach.
Yeah,
I would say.
So actually, so with that, that note of, another is called Lotus Dimension. I guess it's more RPG-ish. And then the other one's called Block by Block, the Insurrection game. And there are some video games also of this light made by indie developers developed via Kickstarter campaign and the like. Those are what those platforms make available to us. So we'll just wrap up the show. Thank you for joining us. We're on Facebook, Three Left Show on Facebook. That's our page, which you can communicate with us. It's where I post show notes, all of the sources, all the quotes and posts. I will share them there in one solid post all together. This is, I'm going to go through the call numbers. This is WCAA, LP. I have a voice in Albany because I'm doing this show, because if it's not our media, it's not our media. Just as if it is not our economy that belongs to us, it is not for us. And that's why cooperatives are so necessary. Enterprises and that are at least co-owned by us, and the moderate compromise is offering stock to employees, but that is not democracy, because not all stock is equal, and you could have a vote, but your vote is, you're still outvoted. You know, that doesn't guarantee a voice on the board of directors. And even if you got, say, one person who's maybe for workers, they could be outvoted. I mean, you're not really. It's just as money is in control of our politics on the national level and all levels. Money is what is political power. So if you want power, so usually the refrain is, well, then you have to earn more money. Well, in this economy, I like to see you try, but usually making a lot of money entails making losers out of people, ripping people off, joining an industry that's exploiting some cadre of workers, or becoming the exploited yourself. And that's a game I would rather not play. So with that, any parting thoughts from my guests today, Eric and Jeremy?
Monopoly is fun, but not realistic in this day and age.
You find it fun? You never flip the board?
That's the funnest part, I think, is flipping the board.
Revolution.
Yeah,
that's what revolution
that's me
is,
rising
flipping
up,
the board.
I would say
it gets the pieces everywhere. It's chaos, but then you have to draw your utopia on the other side of the board, where all the houses are clustered together in an eco village.
Yeah, no, I think
all
that
right.
Sounds much better.
With that part, with that note, this has been the Three Lefts. Thank you for joining us for this odyssey in radical, crazy, spicy discussion, and so on and so on. And with that, I will leave you with music from One Republic.
I can't sleep, no, not like I used to. I can't breathe in and out like I need to. It's breaking out. Everybody is watching you. Everybody is watching me too. Everybody is watching you. Everybody is watching me too. Everybody.